Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lots of politics to untangle and make sense of, if we can, this hour, and none better than to do that than our duo in the Ames studio. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Dave Anderson, assistant professor of political science at ISU. Dave and Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us, Ben.
Well, let's get right to it. Well, first a preview of what's to come, because we know what we're going to talk about. We heard it in the news at the top of the hour. Later in the hour, we'll talk about how Republican David Young, who was defeated by Democrat Cindy Axne last go-around in 2018, now says he wants to reclaim that seat. We'll ask Jim and Dave about that rematch. Also, trade war with China, you've seen in the news. That's been ratcheted up with the president's comments. Also, heightened tensions with Iran, North Korea. Something special halfway through the program. We're continuing a new series where we look at presidential candidates from a home state perspective. We'll talk with a reporter from Indiana about Pete Buttigieg. That coming up all this hour. It's a lot to do, we know, but we can do it. With Jim and Dave's help, let's read the latest headlines and have you comment on those. The Justice Department, within the last hour or so, has informed the House Judiciary Committee that President Trump is asserting executive privilege. That committee voting to hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress. That going on right now. The president's press secretary there, we heard at the top of the hour, just to re-quote her, Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying they're asking for information they know they can't have. The attorney general is actually upholding the law. Chairman Nadler, this is of the judiciary panel there, is asking the attorney general of the U.S. to break the law, according to Sanders, and commit a crime by releasing the information he knows he has no legal authority to have. She says it's truly outrageous and absurd what the chairman is doing, and he should be embarrassed that he's behaving this way. Jim, what's your read on it?
Well, I think this is really an effort on the part of the administration to protect any kind of information coming out. Part of it is because of the grand jury testimony that really cannot legally be released unless it would go to the court. And I think what the Congress wants is for the administration to join them and to go to the court to get the grand jury testimony to be available to them. But I think part of it is, frankly, it's kind of this ongoing debate between the executive and the legislative branch here, whether this will pass muster as protection under executive privilege, I think, will be the question that will be borne out in the courts.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to you, Dave, let's listen to some of the arguments on each side in asserting this executive privilege. Here is House Judiciary Chairman Gerald Nadler responding to the letter this morning, the announcement of the executive privilege.
As a co-equal branch of government, we must have access to the materials that we need to fulfill our constitutional responsibilities in a manner consistent with past precedent. This is information we are legally entitled to receive, and we are constitutionally obligated to review. And I would remind the members that the Mueller report is no ordinary run-of-the-mill document. It details significant misconduct involving the president, including his campaign's willingness and eagerness to accept help from a hostile foreign government, numerous misstatements, if not outright lies, concerning those acts, and 11 separate incidents of obstructive behavior by the president that more than 700 former prosecutors have told us warrant criminal indictment.
Okay. Also speaking this morning at that House hearing, Representative Louie Gohmert, a Republican of Texas, said the majority in the House Judiciary Committee is on the wrong side of history in declaring Barr in contempt of Congress.
There is a disaster that has occurred in our justice system, and this committee has oversight responsibilities, and we are abusing those. This motion for contempt is not being done in good faith.
Gohmert added that Barr, as Sanders did, says he cannot be held in contempt for failing to produce things that are illegal for him to produce. Dave Anderson, weigh in here.
Well, I mean, this is really just becoming a political fight in Washington. Both sides have some merit to their case, but this is really about Democrats in the House wanting to go after the Trump administration. The Trump administration wants to keep the material within the Mueller investigation secret and hidden from not just Congress, but the American people. There are very few laws and strong guidelines that dictate what should happen next. And it's going to be a long political battle of the two sides just fighting against each other.
Join our conversation with Dave Anderson and Jim McCormick, our political scientists this hour. The first part, obviously, talking about what's going on, the showdown between Congress and this administration. Your questions, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, or tweet Iowa Public Radio. I think I heard, Jim, you want to jump in there.
Well, I just wanted to jump in one thing to sort of just add to this, that partly what the Judiciary Committee wants and what Chairman Nadler wants to get access to is kind of the investigative material, not just the grand jury testimony, which is clearly the most, I think, controversial in a legal sense, but also the investigative material that the Mueller people did as a basis of their report. That's what also what was not really said in his statement, but that's what he really liked to get access to, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the key goal of this is Gohmert had mentioned a lack of good faith, and the problem we're having in Washington right now is there is no good faith. Democrats feel like Attorney General Barr absolutely misstated the findings of the Mueller report when he released it, and now they want to go to the core and find the actual evidence that the Mueller report is based upon and reveal that. And they're still hoping to find a smoking gun against President Trump. But
do they want to rewrite the Mueller report then?
I think they do. I think they want to rewrite it so that they can actually show the evidence. Because I think what the Mueller report really says is that there is some evidence of wrongdoing on behalf of the president, but it is not sufficient to warrant prosecution in the courts. And Democrats want to point out that there is evidence of wrongdoing, and Republicans want to point out there's not enough to convict. So.
And there's good political and yet, ammunition there.
And yet, Dave, then respond to this with your comment. Several hundred, I think 700-plus former federal prosecutors publishing a statement this week asserting that President Trump would have been charged with obstruction of justice were he not the sitting president. So he's in a category with one person in it, the president.
He is.
And that is the reason he has not been charged.
Exactly. And nothing about that statement will change. The fact is he probably would be under some kind of prosecution if he were not the president. But he is the president. So Democrats want to really use this as campaign fodder. And I think that's a smart strategy for them. They should point this out.
Okay, give us the reason, the constitutional reason that is interpreted this way, especially by this attorney general, Jim, as to why the president should not be indicted, must not be indicted while in office.
Well, I think actually Barr said that, in fact, Mueller made a statement to the effect that his judgment was not based upon whether a sitting president could be indicted or not. So I'm not sure that that's going to be part of the whole debate between Democrats and Republicans here. And so the basis for Barr's decision, I guess, is that there's not inconvertible evidence that the president violated the law. I mean, that's the only, the only standard that I think that I could come up with.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking on the floor of the Senate yesterday, calling on Congress. Here we see this side wanting to move on from the Mueller report.
With an exhaustive investigation complete, would the country finally unify to confront the real challenges before us? Would we finally be able to move on from partisan paralysis and breathless conspiracy theorizing? Or would we remain consumed by unhinged partisanship and keep dividing ourselves to the point that Putin and his agents need only stand on the sidelines and watch us as their job is actually done for them? Regrettably, the answer is pretty obvious. Yet on this central question, the special counsel's finding is clear. Case closed. Case closed.
Jim and Dave, case closed. Jim or Dave? Yeah, go ahead.
It's humorous just now hearing Senator McConnell talk about this because, of course, he is the one who pushed all the partisan investigations when President Obama was in office. And it's just kind of fun to hear him now act like this is unprecedented and he would never behave like this in his own right. The case is closed to a degree. The Mueller investigation seems to have been exhaustive. They've found a lot of evidence of potential wrongdoing and some lack of evidence that would allow them to convict, most likely. But we haven't seen that evidence. So the case may be closed, but there's a lot that we haven't heard of. And Democrats want to keep the case open just to say, well, if we're not going to prosecute, let's talk about why not. Let's air all the evidence that we can, show it to the American people, because this is a matter that could dictate the future of the country. I mean, we have another election coming up, and the public might have a right to know this stuff.
Dave Anderson and Jim McCormick are political scientists this hour from Iowa State University. 1-866-780-9100. Steve in the Des Moines area is on the line listening to our program. Hi, Steve. What's your question or comment?
Well, I have several brief comments. Number one, I thought that the whole president can't be indicted concept was a Department of Justice policy, not something codified in law, and therefore would be a question best left to the courts. And my understanding of the reason Mueller didn't indict is because that policy, that is, he can't really be tried, and therefore he couldn't have his day in court, the president, I mean. If he were indicted, it would simply be an open-ended indictment of the president, and if he can't be taken to court for it, he can't have his day in court to defend himself, and Mueller thought that unfair in a legal sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Steve, let's try to clear up the points you raised there. Dave, I think you were elaborating on that earlier. Can you help Steve out there?
Well, I think Steve's right. He's absolutely correct that it is not a law that says a president cannot be indicted. It's a Department of Justice policy, and it's not even codified into something firm in the Department of Justice. It's something that they debate. Most presidents want a policy in place that says they can't be indicted for obvious reasons. Presidents do a lot of controversial decision making, and they don't want to be prosecuted while in office, or ever really. But the Department of Justice has a long history of being a little bit ambiguous about this because it's not codified into law. So they generally just say, we don't think that a sitting president can be indicted. However, once that president leaves office, they are subject to indictment. And I think that's something that Mueller was indicating in his report, was that this matter may not be prosecuted right now while Trump is the sitting president. The day he leaves office, all this investigative material will still remain. But right now, it's not in the open. So we have the summary conclusions of the report, but we don't have the evidence that it's based on.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the point. Right now, the House Judiciary Panel debating whether Attorney General Barr should be held in contempt of Congress for not releasing the redacted portions of Bob Mueller's report and the evidence behind it, as you pointed out earlier in the program. I think it was you, Dave, that said there's nothing in the Constitution that really sets this in stone. But if we can look at Jim, to you on this, the Trump administration's behavior here, when measured in face of the efforts by Congress to get more information for its oversight duties, how does that compare with previous administrations, what we're seeing now?
Well, comparable example that's brought up certainly by the Republicans is what happened to Eric Holder, you know, in terms of the contempt of Congress, when he would not, on the Fast and Furious, this was this effort of selling guns, and they ended up apparently in a Mexican cartel, and that, mm-hmm. that also killed a Border Patrol agent as a result. And he was cited for contempt of Congress. And what the Justice Department said was, we're not going to enforce it. And the Congress didn't have much. Well, they did have some options. They could go and get the Sergeant of Arms to strong arm the Attorney General at the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
I mean, that would have been one way. Or they could have gone to the courts and tried to enforce it. What really happened was that the Obama administration let the clock run out on that session of Congress, and the contempt citation died a natural death. I wouldn't be surprised if this same kind of action occurs here. There's a vote on citing Barr for contempt of Congress. The Department of Justice, I think they actually have already said they're not going to enforce it.
Yeah.
So they, you know, so that's a, sort of a dead letter. And would they go then and use the sergeant at arms? I mean, there might be a little bit of political theater in that, but I'm not sure that that would really reverberate very well within the American public here. Just one other thing. I mean, you know, what McConnell said, you know, the legal case might well be closed, at least while Trump is in office. And Dave's right that after he's out of office, he could be subject to, you know, indictment or trial or whatever. But really what is not closed, and this is what really McConnell didn't point out, the political debate over what Trump has done is really the contest right now. And I see part of this, and it really goes to what Dave said, sort of his first comment here, you know, this kind of political action that is being taken place in Washington is really what we're seeing. And I'm not even sure that the Republicans want the political debate to end here. They want the legal debate to end, but do they want the political debate in? I don't think so.
What do you mean exactly? In other words, the political debate.
The political debate over the powers of the presidency, over whether the presidency colluded with Russia or not, whether he obstructed. You know, all of this would be a fodder, it seems to me, for keeping in place Trump's base as well as for Democrats, keeping their base in line. Now, the real question is, in terms of the independents, what does that do to these people that are not so committed to party lines? And I guess there is at least some evidence that that segment of the population is a little bit tiring of this whole political debate by both Democrats and Republicans. That's really what's up for grabs here.
Let's go back perhaps even to a more fundamental sort of base of these questions. The framing of the Constitution by the founders of this nation. What does this mean for the separation of powers, what we're seeing right now, set down in the Constitution, for this idea of three separate co-equal branches of government envisioned there? How does this work with that idea? Does it defy any of that? Is it in such a gray area that the founding fathers have really no clear word to say on this, Dave?
Well, in some ways, this is exactly what the founding fathers intended. You have three co-equal branches of government, and they're attacking each other. The Federalist Papers goes very clearly into this idea that ambition must be made to counteract ambition, and that people are going to defend their own institutions. And right now, the Democrats in the House are arguing that part of their job is to investigate the executive branch and make sure that they're doing their job properly, and the president is hindering their investigation. So they are using the tools that they have in their arsenal. They can cite the attorney general for contempt of Congress. Of course, that raises its own separation of powers issues, because while the House can issue a contempt citation, they can't really do anything about it. They can refer it to the executive branch, which is never going to prosecute its own people. They could refer it to the judicial branch, which could then issue a subpoena. But the only thing Congress could do is exactly as Jim said. They could ask their sergeant of arms to try to arrest William Barr or something. And the Congress actually does maintain a jail in its basement. But nobody's been in it since, I think, 1935, a very long time.
Have you ever seen it, Dave?
I've never seen it.
That would be something to see.
It's something I don't think they show on the tour.
Not on the $10 tour, anyway. Before we go to break, I'd like to get your views on this. Monday of this week, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, denied Jerry Nadler's request for Donald Trump's tax returns. I guess a lengthy court battle will ensue between the lawmakers and the Trump administration. But meanwhile, in New York State, the headquarters of this president's business empire, his home state as well, New York State's lawmakers say they intend to advance a bill today. I haven't kept on it. Perhaps it's already happened, to allow congressional committees to see Donald Trump's New York State returns. It says that the Democrats in the majority in New York State have enough votes to ensure the passage of the bill. So this could return This return could information could contain much of the same financial information as the federal return, right, Jim?
Absolutely.
And I guess in the interest of time here, why do we want to know about these? Why do we have to know about the private dealings in many cases of a businessman going back decades in this country? Why is that important
for his function as president? There was seemingly a certain exaggeration about how wealthy President Trump was, and whether there was any kind of actions that might be questionable, I think, certainly in terms of people's honesty about their taxes. We, I think as a nation, really want that to be the case. So I think that's important. And in terms of the kind of moral authority that the president would have, and that's sort of one of the real powers of the presidency is the moral integrity that he might or she might bring to the office. We'd like to know that, I think, that people are playing the game fairly. I think that's the motivation. Why I think, the Treasury Secretary said, look, that we're not going to turn this over because there's no legitimate legislative interest in it. I think that's also, yes, Congress can have oversight, but they supposedly have oversight because they want to improve the legislative standing of the country to improve, the operation of society here. Mm-hmm. And is it just a curiosity piece, or is there really something that some deductions should not be allowed, that we should really change the tax code? Is that the basis for their inquiry?
Dave, and Dave, don't we also want to know, because we heard today in the New York Times, according to their reporting, that from 85 to 94, Donald Trump's core business lost more than $1 billion. I guess it's worth then asking, when he was puffing himself up as the Midas of the business world, we must ask, is he beholden to any companies, any foreign powers? That's a legitimate question.
I think for a lot of voters, that is the key question. The idea that we don't know what our president's financial interests are and where his financial interests are located, it makes all of his decision-making a little bit suspect. We know that he's been very friendly with Saudi Arabia and Russia and some other countries that we just don't know if he has significant business dealings with them. And if he does, is he making decisions on behalf of the country or his bank?
Back in a moment with Dave Anderson and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. When we come back, we'll talk about the trade disputes with China being ratcheted up. How are your trade disputes with China sitting with you? Are you okay with the message from this president? And we'll hear from Senator Grassley just to wait it out in the showdown with China in this trade dispute. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. In just a moment, we'll get a home state view of presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News with Dave Anderson and Jim McCormick today.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Dave Anderson and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. They are there in the Department of Political Science, and they are here for us today to pick over the latest on the political landscape. Plenty to do. Also later in the program, we'll talk about David Young wanting to reclaim his old seat, the 3rd Congressional District, now in the hands of Democrat Cindy Axne. We'll get their views on that. But today, with Jim and Dave listening on the sidelines for a few minutes, don't worry. We have really big IPR umbrellas there on the sidelines for them, protecting them from the rain. We continue a series of short conversations focusing on Democratic presidential candidates to tell you who they are and what they stand for, but not from the candidates themselves. We hear a lot of that, but based on perspectives from their home states. If you were with us last Friday on this program, we kicked off our series by getting a home state perspective on U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from the state of New York. Today, we get a home state perspective on former Naval Intelligence Officer, Rhodes Scholar, now mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg. Jennifer Weingart is with us. She is senior reporter and assignment editor for WVPE in Elkhart, Indiana. Jennifer, are you there?
I'm here.
Thank you for joining us for a few minutes. Start us off by telling us What kind of leader has Pete Buttigieg been in South Bend? What is his style of leadership?
So Pete has been mayor of South Bend since 2011 when he was 29. So he's a very young leader, which is something that he talks about on the campaign trail as well. But he talks a lot about bringing the city back from where it was. And South Bend is a very industrial kind of place, or it has been in the past, and it's putting a foot forward into technology a lot now, which is something that Buttigieg has been pushing for in his term as mayor. He's big into outreach to companies and businesses for economic growth in the city, and also a lot into making the city fit the people that are living there now. There's a smaller population, and the population of young people has been growing. And I think that from the people that I've talked to, Buttigieg is a big part of that population shift and the shift of business from industry to technology.
Talk a little bit about how he builds the team that he works with and his work with state government. Is he obviously effective that way, I guess?
Well, South Bend is kind of an interesting study because Indiana is an incredibly red state, but South Bend is very blue. And he's a Democrat. He's a Democratic mayor, and South Bend has had Democratic mayors since the 60s. And the team that he's built, he's been working on outreach into the community to bring some people in, and he's done a pretty good job with that. But he's also bringing in people from around the place. The next Democratic nominee for mayor, the elections in November, is someone that he went to high school with and went away like he did, and he convinced to come back to South Bend a few years ago. So he's been working to build a team not only of people that are around South Bend, but trying to bring people back to South Bend because, like a lot of Midwestern, traditionally industrial towns, South Bend has had a brain drain problem.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, he became mayor of South Bend at a very early age, since the age of 29. I believe he's 37 now. When you hear criticisms of his leadership, of what he's done, what are they?
The criticisms tend to be a little bit about that outreach into the community. When he was first elected as mayor, that wasn't something that he was completely comfortable with. He readily admits to being a data guy, and so that human interaction and figuring out how the data really impacts the people in the city was something that he had to learn, and that's something that he has learned. He's reached out into the community, but that's something that I think he sometimes still does struggle with, of figuring out how his policies, how he can get buy-in for his policies that are backed up by data by the people in the community. And there's always some people who feel left behind when a city like South Bend rebounds, and that's another criticism that you hear of his administration, is there's some people in South Bend that have benefited hugely by his policies, but there's always going to be some people who don't benefit as much or aren't benefiting as much as they think they should be.
Jennifer Weingart, before we go, a couple of quick questions about his personal appeal, Pete Buttigieg's appeal. What would you say is at the heart of his political appeal on the personal level? We've seen his popularity, his support really skyrocket in the last month nationwide, right?
Yeah, it really has. And I think that's something people in South Bend have expected for a long time. And I think it really comes down to hearing him speak, because on paper, he's a lot of things. You mentioned he's a veteran, he's a Rhodes Scholar, went to Oxford and Harvard. He has all of these great things on paper. But then you talk to him and he's incredibly well-spoken. And he's really good at connecting with a room. And I think that is a big part of his popularity. His campaign team has done a great job of getting him out there on the airwaves, on TV, in person. And I think people come in expecting him to be something. And then once they hear him speak about his values and what he thinks America should be, they come out with a different perspective on him as a person and as a candidate.
Jennifer Weingart, senior reporter and assignment editor for WVPE in Elkhart, Indiana. Thank you for the home state view of Pete Buttigieg, Jennifer.
My pleasure.
It's our news, not a news buzz, it's a political day here, a Wednesday in the week. News buzz comes at the end. Jim McCormick and Dave Anderson on the sidelines. Back into our discussion, Dave and Jim, you were listening there too. Any comments on that, Jim, that assessment of Pete Buttigieg?
Well, I think it was really enlightening, actually. I didn't know about what actions he had taken with regard to South Bend and this kind of idea of moving into the high-tech area, sort of the STEM area, if you will. I think will probably serve him well in terms of talking about jobs for the future and the kind of changes that had to be made. So that struck me as really quite interesting in terms of, you know, the kind of changes that he's made. One question I did have, and I don't know the answer to it, is how, you know, she said that, you know, there has been a decay effect in South Bend. What is sort of the population of South Bend? I mean, how large an enterprise did he have in terms of governing? That would be sort of the one question I would still have.
Mm-hmm. Your reaction, Dave?
My reaction, I think everybody I have known who's met Mayor Pete has come away thinking that he is extremely charismatic, very smart, very engaging person. And I think he's an interesting presidential candidate. I don't think anybody in America really knew who he was before his candidacy. He's certainly kind of shown on the campaign trail. I do feel like eventually the public is probably going to move on from him, just simply because while he's a very engaging person and clearly has a lot of qualities, I think a lot of voters are going to get stuck with the question of electability and experience. He's very young, and I think he's got a bright political future, but I think he needs a bigger stepping stone than the mayor of a small town.
Well, we are going to step lively here the last 10 minutes or so of our last 10 minutes or so of the program, because we have a lot we want comment on before we go. Let's move on to this development this week. The former 3rd District Congressman David Young, defeated by Democrat Cindy Axne in 2018, announced he will run to reclaim the seat he had in 2020. He was first elected. Young was first he served two terms after, I think, being elected in 2014. Iowa's 3rd District, of course, central and southwestern Iowa, 16 counties, including Des Moines and Council Bluffs. Really an interesting county in terms of registration, equal, more or less, of Democrats and Republicans registered, according to the Iowa Secretary of State. Now, it was in 2018 that Cindy Axne narrowly edged out Young on Election Day. 49% of the vote to Young's 47% turned out to be a difference of about 5,000 votes. Dave, how do you size up this rematch?
Well, I think right now Cindy Axne probably still has the advantage, simply because I think nationwide Democrats are doing a little bit better than Republicans are right now. But this is a razor-thin margin in the Iowa 3rd. The vote will be determined really by the state of the world on Election Day. It's it's one of the few districts in the country where I think the campaigns really matter, and a good campaign, a good favorable series of current events can really tilt the balance of the district.
Now, Jim, Democrats, am I not correct here, tend to vote in greater numbers in presidential election years. So doesn't David Young, based on past elections, face an even greater headwind than he did in 2018?
I'm not so sure, because I looked up the turnout in 2016, you know, and there was a 70% turnout. In 2018, there was a, you know, a 64% turnout. So, I mean, part of it is going to be, I think, a turnout race in across these counties here. And as you probably know, Cindy Axne really only won one county out of the 16 counties in that district. She won Polk County by a really healthy margin, about 33,000 votes here. So I think it will be incumbent upon Young, that's the wrong word, it will be incumbent upon Young to try to get more turnout in these other 15 counties. I mean, one of the things where he failed, I remember after the election talking to one of the Republican consultants for the state Republican Party, and he was saying what really happened was, and what Young really suffered from, was that he didn't get turnout in some of these counties around Des Moines, the kind of the suburban vote. He really lost that, and even though he won the county, the turnout was not sufficient, and you know, his margin of victory was not there. So I suspect, you know, with Madison and Dallas counties, you know, are going to be a kind of a focal point of Young campaign, as well as to up the margin in Poweshiek County, where, you know, Republicans should probably do a little bit better than they did last time. So I think it'll be a really interesting race. But I think that's not the only race in Iowa, that congressional race. I think all four of them are going to be very, very interesting and very tight.
Oh, my, yeah, 2020, the months to come on Politics Day and otherwise, coverage here on Iowa Public Radio will be fascinating. We know that as a very true prediction that will come true. Let's get to the trade war with China. Trump administration officials accusing China of reneging on comments it had already, commitments it had made already in trade talks. The Trump administration now threatening to raise tariffs on $200 billion in imports from China, from 25% to 10%, starting on this Friday. Stock markets have reacted negatively. I haven't looked in the last few hours, but they certainly did yesterday. Senator Chuck Grassley spoke with NPR's Noel King on Morning Edition today, asked him about his support for President Trump's tough stand on China, about how farmers are impacted by the trade war. Grassley told her he would tell farmers to hang on.
If this is all successful, and I know today that's a big if, but if this is all successful, not only is that farmer going to be better off, but the entire world is going to be better off, because free trade has proven itself with the reduction of global poverty, with the enhancement of the middle class worldwide.
And if this is not successful?
If it's not successful, we'll continue to go on and try to accomplish what we can in ways other than China.
Now, to get a sense of how American farmers are feeling about this escalation, NPR's Rachel Martin spoke with Ohio soybean farmer Chris Gibbs. He said the president's rhetoric this week was like a, quote, gut punch, and that while farmers can hang on a little longer, he's worried about the long-term impact of the tariffs.
We established in agriculture over the last 30 years, we've built these relationships, particularly with the Asian community, particularly into China.
Right.
And we built those relationships and we built those markets for hogs, so that hogs would eat soybeans and we could sell them soybeans. And
you see long-term damage to those relationships now.
That's exactly right. And so trading is not a one-off. It's not a win or lose, a one-time win or lose.
Right.
It's a long-term relationship that we've built. And those markets are being really adversely affected by our ability not to be a consistent trade partner.
So what do you make of this plea, Dave, for farmers to hang on, the plea by the president and Grassley?
Well, I think it's really all the president and Senator Grassley can say. They need American farmers to stick with them if they're ever going to win another election. And unfortunately, it's the American farmer who's really bearing the brunt of the tariffs in this country. The farm community is hurting and has been hurting for a very long time. And they can just hold on for just so long. At some point, we're going to see mass bankruptcies across the farming community. And that would be tragic in just an innumerable number of ways. But that's what the president has committed himself to doing. He's trying to force China to change the way they do business with the world. And the strategy has not worked so far, but there's still hope.
Jim McCormick, I want to lean on your foreign policy credentials here for a couple of quick items to finish up our program. Iran is to quit parts of the nuclear deal. We heard in the last 24 hours, the Rouhani, the Iranian president, says his country has stopped complying with two of its commitments under this 2015 agreement, which limited Iran's capacity to produce nuclear fuel for 15 years. Now, this is about a year after our administration, the U.S., Donald Trump's administration withdrew the U.S. from the agreement, although this administration has continued to demand that Iran fulfill its commitments, right?
Yes, indeed. I mean, they would like to. I mean, ideally, the administration would really like to renegotiate any kind of a nuclear deal to get stricter inspections on it, and even have greater limitations in terms of what kind of production of uranium that the Iranians could undertake here. So this is really a kind of a pushback. But of course, there's been these two major events that have really shaped, I think, the Iranian response over the last several weeks. And one was the designation by the United States of the Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization. And then I think even more significantly, the actions of the administration that they would no longer allow these waivers sort of on secondary sanctions with regard to China and India and Turkey and South Korea in terms of purchasing Iranian oil. So that was going to really, if they're really fully put into place, will really have a dampening effect on the Iranian economy.
Mm-hmm. Let's go over to North Korea. Was caught testing a missile again this past weekend. It was not quite a year ago. Boy, time flies. President Trump and Kim Jong-un met for the first time. We remember that that big event.
Sure.
Earlier this year, the two leaders met again. Then we had those talks, abruptly fall apart. Meetings that all meant to lay the foundation for a denuclearized Korean peninsula. Now we have this test. What does this new missile test mean for the process of trying to get the Korean peninsula nuclear weapon free? Jim?
Well, I think it means that probably the whole effort has really met kind of a dead spot, if at all, can be resurrected from this. I mean, I think this is, you know, you got to look back at what the North Koreans have done kind of historically in all of these negotiations. They go one step forward, maybe a half step forward, and then they step back to their traditional plan here. So I think that this, while it doesn't sound the death knell for any negotiations, I think it's really, really a dangerous kind of situation. Coupled with that, you know, the North Korean attack upon the Secretary of State saying they don't want to bargain with Pompeo anymore, you know, makes it even less likely that we're going to see a negotiated outcome here, at least in any kind of short-term schedule.
Mm-hmm. Overall, sort of the big picture of this president's approach to foreign policy. Here's a quote from the New York Times, an analysis by Mark Landler. Jim, react to this. As with so much else in his presidency, Mr. Trump's approach to foreign intervention is largely ad hoc and idiosyncratic, less driven by ideology than by his hunger for foreign policy victories and confidence in his own deal-making skills. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. It's this kind of transactional nature of the presidency, short-term gain without thinking in terms of kind of long-term implications of some of his actions, whether we look at that in terms of the trade policy or in terms of nuclear policy here, or what I might add, that sort of the third dimension of this is in terms of climate change as well. There's really the effort to have short-term kind of success and not really taking real sufficient cognizance of the long-term consequences of some of these actions.
Mm-hmm. Dave Anderson, we have about a minute left. I don't know if you'd like to jump in on what was just Jim was just commenting on, or go off into a unfurrowed field.
No, I think Jim is completely right. It seems like the way President Trump governs, not just foreign policy but domestically as well, is to shoot for these short-term gains with no real strategy or idea of what the long-term strategy of the country is. And that's something I don't think we've ever seen a president do before.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have our little new series looking at the home state perspective of our Democratic presidential candidates. I'm very curious, quickly, what are your plans covering all these candidates in the months to come? Jim, will you get out to see them? Is that what you regularly do, or do you soak up the news, or what do you do?
Well, I soak up the news for sure, and I try to get to see some of the candidates. I was just mentioning today when we're during the break here that, or maybe earlier, that I had actually forgotten that Elizabeth Warren was on campus, and I sort of regret that I didn't get to go and see her, just to get a feel for the candidate and feel for the reaction of people. I think it's much better than sort of watching a couple sound bites on television.
All right, Dave Anderson, your plans for soaking up the 2020 candidates?
So I really do enjoy going out and seeing candidates speak within town. I take advantage of it when I can, and I'm looking forward to meeting all of them.
Okay, very good. This email quickly from a former Hoosier says she loves the show, but she said she didn't like the reference to South Bend as a small town. I don't know whose mouth that came
from. That was me.
She said it's 100,000.
It's 100,000. It's a decently sized small town.
Okay. Reacting to some criticism at the end. Very good. Thank you very much for that comment from our listener Angelica. River to River is thanks to Jim and Dave. Thanks, guys. We'll
Thank
see you
very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Ben Kiefer.